From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, John Landgraf, head of the FX Network, on the unconventional deals he struck with Louis C.K. and Charlie Sheen. Plus, why he passed on Breaking Bad. But first, the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Kim is away, so I am joined today by Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hi, Mike.
Hi, John.
It looks as if Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is no longer what it used to be.
Wall Street finally got its way, being split into two companies, one, of course, focusing more on the entertainment assets of News Corp and the other focusing on the publishing assets.
Now, News Corp is made up of a number of disparate entities. In Hollywood, it's probably best known for 20th Century Fox and Fox Searchlight, its art film division. It has the Fox Broadcast Network. It has Fox News. And on the other side, on the publishing side, it has the Wall Street Journal. It has Dow Jones. And this is a move to kind of break up all the entertainment assets. And I don't know if it's to punish the publishing assets, because they, for a long time, have kind of been carried and supported by the income that the entertainment division has made, and kind of put it out on its own. And I think the real question is, in this new makeup, do newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, New York Post, do they get the support of News Corp that it was able to give it when it had all of this entertainment cash in the same coffers?
Right. Murdoch's an old ink-stained wretch. Yeah, obviously, he started his company in newspapers in Australia and still loves newspapers. I mean, even a few years ago when he spent a ton of money to buy Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. But, you know, Wall Street obviously has been pressuring him to do this for a while. He resisted. Then came along that little scandal, that phone-tapping scandal, which seems to have changed a lot of things over there, and so now this is finally happening, and next up, I guess we'll wait to see who runs the publishing company. It's sure not going to be his son Lachlan, from what it sounds.
No, and it doesn't sound like it's going to be James either, who has been embroiled in the phone hacking scandal. And I think, you know, while the entertainment division of News Corp is clearly very healthy, I think there'd be a lot of people at the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers who'd be a little nervous right now, because they don't know how rosy their future is going to be.
Absolutely.
Speaking of unrosy futures, Ann Curry has stepped aside or been shown the door on the Today Show after a somewhat troubled run on what used to be the dominant morning talk show.
And that's the big problem, is it's no longer the dominant morning show. Good Morning America has really been nipping at its heels, and it's actually won a couple of weeks for the first time in several years. And that's caused some real hand-wringing at NBC. And Ann Curry's the fall guy. The feeling was there just wasn't a lot of chemistry between her and Matt Lauer. And also, maybe she wasn't quite comfortable in the role of having to cook, you know, alongside chefs beyond her strengths, which has always been hard news.
No, it always felt like she was a little bit more comfortable traveling to Sudan, which she did on any number of occasions, than sitting down with Snooki and talking about reality television. And we have talked a lot in the past on this show about NBC and its primetime lineup. So a show like The Today Show, which generates about $300 million in profits every year, generates about $500 million in advertising revenue, it's incredibly important. And the ratings are off about 4% this year, whereas Good Morning America is up about 4%. So this used to be the killer in NBC's lineup, and it no longer is.
Right. I mean, you got to blame some of it on primetime. Eventually, it was going to start to haunt the entire network. And, you know, people just aren't watching NBC like they used to. And as a result, at some point, it was going to impact the Today Show. It's also impacting NBC Nightly News. It's a big network problem. But, you know, the real emphasis has been on the Today Show being such a profit machine. And, you know, they're scrambling over there. I think the hope is the London Olympics will start to turn things around, but we'll see.
Yeah, NBC is already saying they're probably going to lose money in the Olympics. And I think Ann Curry is in some ways emblematic of the battle that's throughout television between entertainment and news reporting. I think we saw the thirst for entertainment, for ratings, really drive what happened last week with the Supreme Court's announcement on the Affordable Care Act.
Right. The competitive nature of the cable news networks came back to haunt both CNN and Fox News. They got it so wrong completely when the verdict was first announced. Granted, it wasn't easy at first to figure out just what was going on, but CNN and Fox News both went on and went ahead and said the mandate had been struck down by the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court had ruled it unconstitutional. Of course, we know now that was completely inaccurate, but there's a lot of egg on cable news' face.
Yeah, who needs more than 30 seconds to digest a 200-page opinion? It reminds me a little bit of when Martha Stewart was convicted, all of the not guilty, not guilty, guilty, guilty verdicts. And I think television, like a lot of journalism, has to stop, assess what its strengths are, do the story right the first time, and not do what happened with Nora Ephron, where some media outlets were reporting her death before she had even passed away.
Again, a reminder that we live in this social media, Twitter, and online age where people aren't taking a moment to just take a breath, see the forest for the trees, and really figure out what's going on.
I'm going to take a long breath right now. Thank you, Michael.
Exhale. Thanks, John.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. I'm John Horn of the LA Times.
I'm Saul Gonzalez, filling in for Kim Masters. Coming up later in the show, why FX got into business with Charlie Sheen. But first, the network's very hands-off deal with comedian Louis C.K. Last week, the critically acclaimed comedy Louis returned to FX for its third season. The show is created, written, and directed by comedian Louis C.K., who stars in it. In fact, he's so hands-on with this show, he was its editor for the first two seasons, cutting scenes on his laptop. Suffice to say, C.K. has total creative control over the show, which is based on his life as a comedian and single dad of two daughters.
My kids, I love my kids. My daughter told me a joke the other day, and she tells great jokes. They're not like anybody else's jokes. That's why I like them. I've been doing comedy for 25 years. I know every joke. Even if I haven't heard it, you start telling me a joke, I know how it's going to work. But her jokes, I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea. This is the joke she told me the other day. She said, who didn't let the gorilla into the ballet? Who didn't let the gorilla into the ballet? Already, I love this joke. I love this joke. I have not heard this joke. This is a new joke for me. Who didn't let the gorilla into the ballet? And I said, who? And she said, just the people who were in charge of that decision.
Watching Louis is to know the mind and art of Louis C.K. There are scenes you would never see in a conventional comedy, like when he was driving and sang the entire 3-minute Who song, Who Are You?, while his daughter sat bored in the back of the car. And Louis C.K. doesn't have any network executives looking over his shoulder. They basically wire him money, and he sends them a show. C.K. struck this deal a couple of years ago with FX president John Landgraf. Landgraf recently sat down with Kim to outline what's come to be known in the business as the Louis C.K. deal.
So just tell us how that came to be. Did he come and did he pitch? I know he was being, I think, courted by broadcast network.
Yeah, he was actually pitching at that time. There were sort of two shows he wanted to do. He had made, in the aftermath of Lucky Louie on HBO, they had allowed him to go out and shoot films, and he's an incredibly talented filmmaker. He has his own lenses, his own camera, he does his own editing, and he had shot these really funny films, but they were kind of random in that they were just anything Louis wanted to make a little film about, and they had no real organizing principle behind them. He was also pitching a sitcom essentially based on his life as a newly divorced single dad who, you know, had shared custody of his two daughters. So we heard that pitch. Networks offered him, I think, quite a bit more money, maybe twice as much money to actually write a script as we offered him to shoot an entire pilot. But what I said after I talked to him is that, you know, I just don't see him as Jim Belushi, as a guy who's going to end up...
Broadcast network guy.
Yeah, the guy, the funny guy standing on a set in front of a live audience saying lines that were written by other writers. He's really an auteur. So I said to him, well, look, you're not going to like this because you're going to end up with one show instead of two. But the truth of this matter, you're a great filmmaker. Why don't you make your films but orient them around the thing you want to make your sitcom about, which is to say your present tense life as a working comedian and a newly single father of two daughters, so that there's an emotional realism and emotional grounding. Within that, you can make your films about anything you encounter in life and anything you want to do. And because you're a stand-up, we don't have to do a structure where there's an A scene and a B scene and a C scene and a D scene and where everything is narratively organized and ordered. You can just basically not do any scene that you want to do. Just do the meat of what you want to tell a story about, and you have a matrix that you can organize it around, which is your stand-up comedy. Other than that, you can do literally anything you want. So Louis said, well, I really suck at rewriting. He said, I like to shoot my first draft. I don't like to get notes. I don't like to do rewrites. I can't work that way. And we literally dickered back and forth. I said, look, if you want this much money, I think he wanted like $500,000 an episode. And I said, I can't give you $500,000 of an episode of News Corporation's money without giving you notes. But if you let me give you this much money, and I think he made that pilot for maybe $225,000, then we gave him another $30,000 or $40,000 to finish it when we put it on air. And then I think in the first season, the episodes cost maybe $300,000. I said, that's so little money in relative terms that I can't lose the company's money if I give you that. We'll break even or something close to it. So if you can make it for that little money, then I'll give you this. I'll wire you the money and you send me a show. And literally, that's the way it works.
That included his fee.
It did. I said, look, I don't care. You can, I don't care. We won't audit you. I don't care what you, you can.
You can pay yourself $195,000 and shoot $5,000 worth of film.
And look, the reason that works with Louis is because Louis is literally one of the hardest working, most perfectionistic people you've ever met. I mean, he was really funny. He called me. You know, after he'd been making the first season, he said something akin to, you know, I don't know if I could say this on the radio, but he said, you bastard. And I said, what? And he said, I now realize, you know, that your plan was that I'm killing myself. I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating because I have no one to blame if this isn't the best show ever made because it's all me. No
right.
one stands in my way. But Louis is the kind of guy whose attitude is, well, look, I'm just going to work 24 hours a day if I have to. Because this is me.
I mean, there was a story that was reported in the New York Times of that you did a focus group on the pilot, and they said that it was a bummer that the dog died at the end of the pilot, and you said, here's the strongest data we've got, and as the network president, I'm urging you to ignore it. Now, I have to tell you, when I read that, I thought that never happened.
No, it did happen.
It did happen?
It really did.
Because
sometimes focus – look, people don't always know what they want. That's the problem with research, the problem with focus groups. I mean, what group of people could tell you what we really want is Avatar, or what we really want is South Park, or what we really want is The Simpsons? Those things didn't exist in anything like that form before they existed, and people loved them. So creative people's job, I think, are to imagine the existence of things that don't exist. And people can't always tell you what they want, and they're often confused by really innovative work until they're not. On the other hand, they can definitely tell you what works for them and what doesn't work for them and why. Whether or not they know the language of filmmaking and the language of writing, they're very articulate about their own feelings and their own experience. And I not only do research, I actually watch the research. I don't read somebody's summary of how people reacted. I sit oftentimes with my executives and we actually watch
through the one-way mirror?
Yeah, or we stream them on the internet if they're taking place in a remote town. And sometimes they clarify or sharpen my understanding of the work, because what happens is we get too close to it. You know, once we've seen it, once
right.
we've given notes, we get too close to it. So it provides objectivity. I mean, that was a story that Louis told. And it was a really, really funny but incredibly tragically dark story about his dog dying when he was young. And it was really a story about his existential viewpoint on life, his dark existential viewpoint on life. So could we take that out? Yeah, we could have taken that out. But if you're going to watch Louis, that's what you're going to get. So it's not as if we were going to take it out and fool people. They're going to come out the next week and say, oh, this is a happy show filled with light and sunshine. So the other side of it is, look, if you're going to work with really, really creative artists and you're going to try to make really good shows, they're going to make their shows.
I heard he sent you, I'm not sure if he still does, at the beginning there was like a little hello, John message
yeah.
from him.
He hasn't done that. So far I've seen 5 of the new episodes this year, and he hasn't done that this year. And I kind of miss it, to tell you the truth.
What did he say?
Well, he said, you know, hi, John, you know, hi, Nick, you know, all of our executives. I'm a little nervous showing this to you. And, you know, here's what I was trying for and here's what it's about. And, you know, I hope you like it. Because he was, you know, it's really interesting. When somebody doesn't have to get notes, they actually want notes. They want feedback.
I was going to say, do you ever give him notes at this point?
Yeah, but I got to be honest with you. The notes that I've given Louis almost over the entire time really were kind of pacing notes. They were often, hey, I just think if you take, you know, 20 frames off this shot or you take 20 seconds out of this sequence, it'll be paced, paced a little better.
That's not granular.
No. That show is exactly the show that Louis makes, and we make very, very little creative impact on it.
Has he been able to shake you down for more money?
Yeah, sometimes. But it's always been worth it. Like, the one script I've ever read of Louis's was he wanted to do a one-hour episode set in Iraq that was really based on his U.S.
Oh, right.
The show was set in Afghanistan. He had gone to Iraq. And he needed two episodic fees, so he needed me to pay him double. And he said, I know you can't give me that money without a script, so I'm going to send you a script. So he sent me this script, which was just stunning. It was like reading The Bicycle Thief or something like that. And I didn't even know he wrote scripts until that. It turns out he writes a script for every episode. In fact, he had all 13 scripts written before he went. He even shot the shows. He just doesn't show them to us, and he doesn't show them to anyone, except sometimes I think Chris Rock or Vernon Chapman, who, you know, Chris is his friend and Vernon is a producer on the show, but he doesn't want to rewrite. He just really thinks that the rawness and even imperfection of a first draft isn't worth sacrificing for what you get when you refine something, which I think is kind of cool.
If you're just joining us, I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters. Kim's talking with FX president John Landgraf, who was just discussing his unusual business arrangement with Louis C.K. for the show Louis, which premiered its third season last week. Landgraf is one TV exec who's open to unconventional deals with talent. Another example is Charlie Sheen, star of the new comedy Anger Management.
What the hell are you doing?
You asked me to a movie after sex. It obviously represented your symbolic need to cuddle. You're getting emotionally attached to me. And we don't want that. Ergo, Judy.
Are you completely mental?
No, Charlie. I'm reestablishing that we are not in a romantic relationship. We are friends. I'm your therapist. We have sex. I do not want things to get weird.
While Anger Management runs on FX, it's owned and produced by Lionsgate, which proposed a novel deal to FX chief John Landgraf. Under its terms, they go straight to a 10-episode season without shooting a pilot. FX then licenses the show and agrees to air all 10 episodes. And if they hit a certain number of viewers, the network agrees to air 90 more episodes. Yeah, 90. Add to the mix Charlie Sheen, the most volatile star in town, and it doesn't seem like something a network chief would want to get anywhere near.
And if you don't hit the 10, the ratings in the first 10, can you see, I mean, would you, is there a world in which you say, I don't care, let's go forward, or do you just pull the plug?
I think if we were close, we might go forward, because I actually think the show's really good. And, you know, we have a history on the channel of betting on shows that we think are good. If it misses by a mile, we won't go forward. If it's close, maybe we will.
I mean, I know you're not going to tell me where the bar is, but could you say whether it's a high or low bar for the ratings?
I think it's pretty high, you know. I think when they negotiated with us, I think they were quite confident about the ability to generate an audience. And
right.
Look, I think there'll be a lot of curiosity for the show, which is why the first two episodes don't actually count in terms of the rating
because
threshold.
Because that will skew the number so
exactly.
Radically. Yeah.
And people will stay if they like the show, if it makes them laugh.
Have you personally taken any blowback from the industry, like, why are you doing this with this guy? Or
no, I called Warner. I know Peter Roth really well, who runs Warner Brothers and
television.
You know, and I said, look, you know, I'm sorry you guys had such a tough time with Charlie, but you know, we're going to take a shot on this. And look, it's just business. It's not personal, you know. And he said, thank you for the call. I understand.
Because they were pretty bad at the time. I think very unhappy.
Yeah, look, I don't think Warner Brothers wants to work with Charlie, but I don't think they can tell everybody in the industry not to work with Charlie. That's not the way the business works.
Coming up after a short break, more on the FX bet on Charlie Sheen, plus why John Landgraf passed on Breaking Bad. If you want to make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters. Kim's talking with President and General Manager of FX, John Landgraf. He's a longtime TV guy who did a stint as vice president of primetime at NBC during the network's heyday. And since 2005, he's made FX, the once little outpost of the News Corp empire, a vital piece to that media company's bottom line. Now, the FX network has a reputation for being guy-centric, with shows like Sons of Anarchy and Justified and The League. They've also done well with repeats of Two and a Half Men. So the new show, Anger Management, starring Charlie Sheen, seems like a natural. Still, when Landgraf recently sat down with Kim, he acknowledged the high risk of working with Sheen.
I went into the pitch fully convinced that I was there out of respect for Lionsgate and respect for Bruce Helford, who's the showrunner, and respect for Charlie Sheen, but that there was virtually no chance we were gonna get involved in the show. But if I'm sitting there listening to a pitch, I'm hearing creative people talk about a show, talk about their creative vision, and I liked it. I just really liked it. And I think one of Charlie's saving graces is his honesty and ingenuousness. He's not hypocritical. He doesn't hide who he is, for better and worse. And look, he was very direct in the pitch about feeling bad about the way that Two and a Half Men ended and about feeling right now that that is his legacy and really wanting to change that, rewrite, you know, the end of that story, you know, wanting a better legacy for himself. And to me, the subtle clue that I've been going on is the character that Charlie chose to play. The character that Charlie played in Two and a Half Men was a character who's, you know, wildly talented, a really gifted musician, really charming, and just bulletproof, just has no consequences. And the character he's playing in Anger Management is a character whose entire life is constructed around trying to heal and deal with the consequences of bad choices he's made in his life. Not only does he do that for a living, but he still struggles with anger issues. And his entire life is surrounded by women, from a, you know, an awkward adolescent daughter who he's trying to be a good father to and model to, an ex-wife who has questionable taste in men.
You're talking about the show now, not
yes,
reality.
Exactly. His best friend is a woman who's his colleague, who's a therapist. Brett Butler plays a bartender at the place where he hangs out. I mean, literally, he's surrounded by women, and he's face-to-face every day with the consequences of bad decisions, up to including his baseball career, which he ruined when he broke a bat over his knee in anger and shattered his knee. So the fact that Charlie was choosing to play a character who parallels probably what Charlie ought to be doing in his personal life, that is to say, dealing with the consequences of actions and reconciling with the women in his life, made me feel like he meant it.
Should Charlie, in the middle of this, flame out again? I assume there's something contractual that says, okay, you're not. Because, you know, the thing about Two and a Half Men is the line you heard from Warner Brothers that produced the show and from CBS until the bitter end was, you know, he shows up, he's fine.
Right.
What problem? You know, maybe he's got problems, but he's hitting his marks. You know, what does he have to do to be
right,
a problem for you?
Well, look, I don't have control over Charlie's personal life, nor should I. You know, typically if somebody commits a crime, then they're not going to work for a publicly traded company and in a highly public context. You know, my primary concern is his work life, and it not only concerns, you know, how good a job he does and whether he shows up on time, but, you know, how he treats his fellow cast members and how he treats the other people. By the way, so far that set is a wildly, exuberantly happy set, and he's created a beautiful, safe place for the other actors. They're all thrilled with the job. But I don't have a crystal ball. You know, there could be a problem in Charlie's life that's not only a problem for him, but a problem for us and all of his other business partners. You know, I've made a bet that that won't happen. And, you know, I hope that bet pays off. I guess what I feel in general about my job is that I think those of us who do this are kidding ourselves if we think that there's a rational, logical, linear decision-making process that yields to success. It's always risky. Inherently, what you're doing is you're taking bets on a very inchoate thing called the creative process and ideas, really, that they will become stories and environments that will attract millions of viewers, and you're betting on creative people who are almost always fragile on some level because they're so gifted, because they're so sensitive. So I just look at this as a risk within you know, a whole series of risks. You could define my my career by the series of risks I've taken. I think this one is a little more high profile and more public because of how famous Charlie is. But the nature of these jobs, and anyone who does any one of these jobs will tell you, is that you succeed in public and you fail in public.
So you're pretty guy-centric at this point with your programming. And do you see yourself chasing more female viewers? Not that advertisers care about them for their own inscrutable reasons to me. We do spend money, we ladies.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the average audience for our shows, for our dramas, is only about 55% male. It's 45% female. That's a lot of female viewers because those shows get a lot of viewership. And we've won a tremendous number of awards, all the way back to CCH Pounder, who got nominated for an Emmy for The Shield. Glenn Close, who won, you know, multiple
Emmys.
You did.
That was your Damages, was your biggest female-driven show. And,
right.
And you've said publicly that you wouldn't do it again. I don't know if it's about money or...
No, that was about the density of the serialization and the fact that I felt at the end of the day we were making a show that was much better viewed on DVD than viewed on commercial television.
You had to kind of marry it.
You really did. It wasn't a show you could date. But look, we made
tried.
The Riches with Minnie Driver. She got a nomination. We made Dirt with Courtney Cox.
Yeah.
I mean, we've tried over and over again. I think we really try to make richly human and humanistic shows, even though they're rather dark. And women really like our shows. The problem is that women are super served by existing channels. So if you look at the broadcast networks and you look at scripted programming on the broadcast networks, the dominant audience for scripted programming is female.
Right.
And similarly with TNT, very female. You have Lifetime, Oxygen, We, E. You know, so part of the problem is we just have trouble as a channel competing, whereas younger men are this elusive kind of missing demographic. They watch some sports, but oftentimes with young men, you'll see that our scripted show is the number one show in television and it's dominating the broadcast networks. You know, that said, we've had two shows that were very female skewing. Nip Tuck was 60% female in its viewership, and American Horror Story, 60% female in its viewership. And again, Jessica Lange and Connie Britton were two of the leads in that. So it's not a lack of will.
Why do you think it is that Mad Men and Breaking Bad, why are you sort of, you won some Emmys for the women, but why are your guys not getting the same kind of traction, do you suppose? Does that annoy you?
No, because look, the Michael Chiklis was the breakthrough guy. He was the first actor to win an Emmy in a basic cable show for The Shield. I just think, you know, AMC has some really hot shows right now. I mean, just the reality of it is that Mad Men and Breaking Bad are just really hot shows.
You passed on Breaking Bad.
I did.
Why?
Well, if you go back to when we did, we had Nip Tuck, The Shield, and Rescue Me. So we had three dramas with male anti-heroes. And we looked at that script and said, okay, so here's a fourth male anti-hero. And we didn't have comedies at that time. You know, Sunny had premiered, but it wasn't meaningful, and that was the only comedy we had on the air. So the question was, are we defining FX as the male anti-hero network, and is that a big enough tent, essentially? And look, if I had known that it was a wonderful script, if I had known that Vince Gilligan was going to be one of the best showrunners in television,
genius guy.
And Breaking Bad was going to be literally one of the very best shows in television,
yeah,
I would have picked it up despite the concept. But the truth of the matter is anybody who does what I do for a living who's honest will tell you that, you know, you're making decisions based on too little information all the time, and you make good ones and you make bad ones.
John Landgraf is the president and general manager of the FX Network. Thank you so much for coming in.
I am delighted to be here.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.